Hey there, foreigners. This is Rohit from BreakingTheBorders.com, home of the ambitious immigrants. Today's guest has an incredible story. He got his MBA from Cornell, after which he founded two companies. And it is at this time, at the peak of his career, he decided to leave everything behind to travel around the world and volunteer. After a three-year sabbatical, he returned back to California to start another company, which helps startups build scalable, predictable, and repeatable companies. He's also an advisor at 500 Startups. Samir, welcome to Breaking the Borders podcast.
Oh, thank you so much, Rohit. Appreciate the invitation.
Starting with your travel experience, when you took it up, you were arguably at the peak of your career, right? What was the driving force behind taking that action?
Well, the driving force was that there was another peak besides the peak to the career. And I think the peak to the professional career was what I was already doing. But the peak to me as a human being, you know, to grow and develop was the next peak was to give and share with other people. And in fact, that really doesn't take anything from who you are, but it ends up expanding who you are. So I went for an upgrade, not a downgrade in any way.
So was there a moment that pushed you over the edge to take this up?
Yeah, I think there were a series of moments. I think one was definitely that overall, I had a burnout from my company for sure. And on top of it, my dad suddenly passed away. So usually, you know, death is a very good reminder of life, right? And you get jolted into existence and reality, and you are able to sit back and reflect a lot more on life than what you're used to, because the day-to-day tactical things, you know, life is just in its own momentum. And death is kind of like a traffic light where you have to look left, right, forward, backward to see, you know, what you have been up to. And I think that was a big turning point for me.
I see. Yeah, that's a good metaphor that you used. So you decided to leave all that is going on behind, and you went to travel in Nepal and in India. So you traveled 1,000 kilometers across Himalayas on foot. Is that right? What was it like?
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, half of the journey for me was doing a parikrama around the river Narmada. And half of it was walking around the India-Tibet border in the mountains. So half of it I did, the river parikrama I did without money and two pairs of clothes. So I was literally going from home to home, you know, asking for refuge, you know, asking for food. And it's ultimately a huge practice in humility. And Narmada, the word Narmada means, Nar is ego, and Mada is to kill it in some ways or reduce it. And the whole practice is around developing a lot of humility in yourself and being full of gratitude for other people.
So how exactly are you saying that traveling so many miles results in humility? How are they connected? Can you dig a little deeper on that?
Yeah, surely. So first of all, in the modern world, we are all used to having stuff, right? By stuff, I mean, you know, car and blankets and, you know, cycles and, you know, our wardrobe is full of clothes and all that stuff. And basically what essentially you're securing yourself more and more, right? But when you have to walk, you have to carry as little as possible. As little as possible in your backpack, because you'll get really tired just carrying all your stuff around, right? So you may have a garage full of stuff, But then you would only take what you absolutely need. And I think what happens is you are kind of surrendering that security to the world, and you're only carrying absolutely what you need. So, you know, your hospital, which is a little bit of a first aid kit, is in your thing, you know, in your backpack. You have a little bit of your kitchen, which is a couple of food packets in it, right? You have your whole wardrobe in a backpack. So you pretty much have your entire life. You have your tent, which is your room or living room and bedroom in your bag. So you're pretty much, what you're doing is you are letting go of this huge security, right? And I also walked without money, which means that's the ultimate security, because you're able to do a transaction. You're able to give another human being something and actually get something from the return. But when you lose money, you don't have an ability to buy anything. So yeah, I think it's just giving up security. And I think when you, and the second is, when you give up security, you have to surrender to fellow human beings, right? And be open to what's given to you as opposed to what you can get. So like, you are subjected to asking for food from people. You're subjected to asking for shelter, which are the two basic securities, right? And physical security. And you're pretty much at the disposal of others, right? Like, what if they're kind, you get treated kindly. If they're not kind, you don't get treated kindly. So you're like giving up your whole body and your mind to.
So you went from a luxurious life in the U.S. to, you know, living on two pairs of clothes and a tent and a little bit of food on your backpack. So was there ever a moment when you regretted taking up this journey?
Oh yeah, many moments. And one of them, I'll tell you, is that one night I entered a village, and hadn't eaten like for the last 6 or 8 hours. It wasn't a proper place to sleep. I didn't get a home. It turned dark so much. I entered a village, and then I had to sleep at a primary school outside. And it was really cold. I didn't have a blanket. I didn't have dinner. And it was the night of Diwali, the next night. So, you know, I was usually with family and having a feast and celebrating, right? But here I was like sleeping in some random school. And then I started, and I was so tired that I didn't even have, you know, energy to go and ask for food. So I slept, and then suddenly I felt something next to me, and like really jolted me, like some weird thing that was moving next to me in this darkness. And when I got up and looked around in the dark, like there was this really dirty dog, you know, like he's like literally from the gutter, and he's trying to get warmth from me and like sleep next to me. And that really tricked me off. I'm like, oh my God, what if, you know, all these street dogs have rabies, right? And it's, and you're in this bad place, and you're like, you haven't eaten, and, you know, I had high blood sugar at that time. And I'm like, what the hell am I doing with my life? You know, I have got a Ivy League MBA, and I worked so hard. I was the CEO of a company, and I'm doing all these things. And what the F am I doing, you know, sleeping with a dirty dog in the middle of like this crazy village? I don't know anybody there. You know, what if somebody robs me? What if somebody hits me, you know? And I think that moment really, really questioned. It's like, what is the point of walking? You're just walking and walking and walking more. And where are you going? There's no destination, right? And yeah.
So personally, you questioned yourself, right? What am I doing? Was it ever, there was ever a frustration from your family members? Being Indian, I can relate to what my mom or dad or family would say if I said I wanted to go travel the world and leave my job, right? So what was it like from your surroundings?
Yeah, it was heavy discouragement even from my parents here and also from my relatives in India, because it wasn't like they wanted to discourage me, but it was more that they did not understand, you know, because, you know, they themselves hadn't explored something like this. And it's hard to derive meaning out of walking and doing a parikrama, right? Because it's just so, the work is so internal and it's so personal that it's hard for people to really understand except yourself, because there's so many experiences and changes that are going on within yourself. That's why it's called like a self-inquiry, right? It's not for reality TV, you know?
Did you even attempt explaining or trying to reason it out with them, or you just went ahead with it?
Yeah, I think initially I really had knee-jerk reactions, you know, meaning like I was just frustrated and I'm like, there's no point explaining. And I had negative reactions. But then after I did this, I learned to be patient. And, you know, one of the things walking teaches you and humility teaches you is to be patient with people and be nice and explain it from the best of your heart. And also I learned that it's okay if people don't understand it, right? Like when you're traveling on a highway, right, there's some cars ahead of you, some cars behind of, right? And some are like 50 miles away, some are with you, and some are like 100 miles, you know, from you, like in the front. So that's how people are. People are at different phases of their journeys. Some people may be lifetimes behind you or ahead of you, right? Or some people might be just years ahead and behind. So it's okay to be behind. And I think it's behind or ahead. But I think our job is to just explain who we really are and what we are doing with like the best heartfulness possible, right? And a lot of love and compassion for others. And it's okay if they don't understand it. But I think we have to do our job to be authentic to ourselves.
I must say that must be definitely motivating for someone out there thinking of doing something non-traditional and getting some resistance from the society or family, right? So you would recommend being patient and still trying to explain.
And still do, absolutely do what you need to do, right? And especially as immigrants, we are in default, we are in survival mode, right? And so are our parents, right? Because most people who immigrate are, you know, kind of middle class, right? In their own countries. And they have come here to do better, right? So in our countries, most of us were in survival mode. And you know, we wanted, and I think our parents and our families are structured around basic necessities, right? So that's why when it talks about taking any kind of risk, the first thing is to keep to the norm, right? Because that's what safe is.
Yeah. So switching gears a little bit here, tell us what you're doing right now.
Yeah. I think right now I am doing a company that helps companies grow, and my focus is digital marketing. And the idea, I've been a pioneer in bringing data science and quantitative finance and quantitative marketing techniques to online marketing, right? And I think there's a huge innovation happening there. You know, you must have heard of big data and bringing in the quants, right? Bringing in the statisticians. Hal Varian, who's the chief economist of Google, said, you know, statistician job will be the sexiest job of the 21st century, right? And so there's a lot of intelligence happening around analytics, and, you know, marketing is becoming more and more quantitative, right? So my idea is to, you know, raise this awareness out there with companies. And I think the second piece of work I'm doing or attempting to do is to serve people who are working on the mind, right? Like things like mindfulness, you know, things that can make a human being help enable a human being to be better themselves, right? By knowing more about the mind. So you could call it mind science or mindfulness or meditation, right? So I think those are the second part of the practice is that doing it myself and supporting people who do that, because I feel that can bring about a fundamental change in the history of humanity.
I see. So I'm on your LinkedIn profile here, and I see the quote, grow fast or die slow. I can so relate to that, right? Even from my podcast point of view, if I have, I either have to quickly scale or I'm driven out completely. So can you tell a bit more about that mindset in general?
Yeah. I'll give you an example. There was a study done on ice creams, right? And the consumption of ice creams and the flavors of ice cream, right? And they found that vanilla and chocolate dominated almost 40% of the overall consumption, or sometimes even 50% in different countries, right? And all the other flavors like strawberry, raspberry, you know, mint, all those things, really didn't score that well. They were very minute pieces. They were 1 or 2% off, you know. So if you look at 200 flavors, you know, that are available, vanilla and chocolate took up more than 40%, right? That says a lot about actually startups and also anything that you do, right? I mean, how many search engines do you use? One. You know, how many, you know, shopping engines do you use? You know, one. Amazon, right? Mostly. And I think that because there will only be a few winners, like probabilistically, the outcomes are binary, right? So it's either zero or one. So zero would be die slow, or one would be grow fast, right? So grow fast or die slow. So that's why growth is really, really important, and momentum and speed is really important for startups.
Yeah. You can finish your thought.
No, go ahead. So that's why you see these funding rounds to be gigantic, right? Like $500 million for Airbnb or $1 billion for Uber, is because these investors are trying to make these companies as big as possible, right? And monopolies as fast as possible, because then they have so much market power that other people cannot get in.
So Samir, I've seen your other interviews, and you talk a lot about growth being a mindset rather than a tactic or a trick. So what advice do you have for startups out there to develop this mindset and really think big?
Yes. So I think there's two components to the mindset, right? One is be a scientist, right? So you are automatically discovering, you know, just like a scientist experiments in a lab, you come up with an objective, then you come up with hypothesis, then you come up with experiments, then you record those results in a lab, and then conclude, right, and improve your next test and lab test based on that. So marketing and startups are becoming very, very scientific in a way that you would do marketing, right? You would do product development. So my first advice around the mindset issue is, you know, be very rigorous, you know, be very data-driven, be analytical, be experimental, right? So that's the first part of the mindset. I think the second part of the mindset is don't do what other people do, right? So if one person is promoting their startup or a product, advertising on Google AdWords or Facebook ads, just don't copy people, right? Just, I mean, you can still do it, but your default more shouldn't be like, oh, I want to get customers, let me just buy ads, right? You, instead of that, think of some creative way to get virality, right? Think of some different way to build up your customer base. So I think thinking different by default and making it a DNA of your company, right, is a huge portion of being a scientist, right? And I think the second big part to it is following process. So a lot of growth people talk about tactics. You know, you should advertise here, you should do email marketing. Instead of that, like focus on the underlying process, right? And the process will give you the answers. There is no right answers or wrong answers, and there's no definitely no packaged answers. So your process of following scientific inquiry and bringing rigor will automatically give you the right answers. So those are my two top things.
I see. Yeah, keep searching until you find the magical thing.
Yeah, and as you see in your own experience, right? Even you know, doing podcast, right, is a series of small improvements, you know, every day. And you reflect on the results and you change again. And it's like a continuously iteration cycle.
Exactly. My first interview to the current interview, there is so much difference right now. Even what I ask and the quality and it's a constant improvement. And it has... Yeah, I watch for that as well. So you mentioned that your current company is sort of related to your previous company before you took this sabbatical, right? What was it like to start your very first company in the US?
So I think it is an amazing experience because, you know, I've been, as I mentioned to you, you know, I've grown up in India, you know, for almost 19 years. And, you know, I bought my first bike. I paid some way through my high school. You know, I paid for my first moped, you know, or a scooter, right? So I've always been an entrepreneur. Like I used to have stalls. I used to run a library when I was 8. So when I came to the Valley, like I hated absolutely hated computers, shockingly, before I came to the US. So the first 20 years, I just ended up hating computers forever, right? But when I saw the internet the first time in the Valley, I was like blown away because it was so much more fun than punching in, you know, basic code. There were colors and there were browsers and there was so much to learn, right? So when I was able to start my own company, that was like a big dream come true, right? And even before that, I had worked for startups and really prepared myself to do my own thing, right?
Okay. How did you prepare yourself? Like, what exactly did you do to prepare yourself for that?
So, you know, in ancient times, they had this concept of apprenticeship, right? Where all these artists used to go and a lot of the times work for free, right? For major sculptors, right? Or major painters. And like they would do all the grunt work, but then they would get to hang out and learn from the masters, right? You can see what the masters do every day. And I think the idea would be if you want to do your own company, one of the options, well, one is to just jump in and make a lot of mistakes and learn and crash and burn and or just be successful, who knows, right, the first time. Or the other approach is to work with people who have been successful, right, or people that you admire, right, and people you can learn from. So there's a lot to learn from big companies, you know, which is much more structured and much more process driven, and there's a lot to learn from startups where they're actually very fast and nimble, and they, you know, they focus on creativity and they work, you know, with very little, right? So I say, you know, you learn to eat like a bird and poop like an elephant. Very little resource,
that's a good
but you produce a lot, right? So you learn that from startups. So yeah, I would say like both are good. You know, you want to learn from the larger guys and the smaller guys, and you get this benefit of, you know, not risking your own time or capital.
So your full-time work at startups actually kind of got you closer to the day-to-day dealings of a startup world, which helped you prepare for your own venture when you had to do it.
That's correct. That's correct. And it gave me a lot more confidence. It also gave me a good network to tap into. If I needed investor connections, if I needed some, you know, hiring connections. So because your network is really important, right? And if you haven't worked anywhere, you know, how are you going to have a professional network?
Yeah. Are you comfortable sharing what visa status were you on when you first started your very first company?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was fortunate that I didn't have any visa issues. You know, I've had green card from my parents, and then I got a citizenship. So, you know, I didn't really have to go through any math.
Okay. But, that must have made it a lot easier.
Yeah. But I wouldn't let that stop anybody. You know, I have known people who, you know, have done it, you know, without, and taken the plunge, even though they're in the middle of visa issues. I mean, Exodus, which is, you know, the first huge successful company by Kanwal Reiki in the Bay Area, right? That was an inspiration to so many people. They had to go through those things, right? Clearly. They just plowed through it and figured out how to still make it work. So,
yeah, absolutely. I'm talking to all the entrepreneurs who are immigrants, and there are so many visa types which can help you take the entrepreneurial leap as well. And most of the listeners have heard it on other interviews too.
Exactly. And I mean, the good part is, look, if you are on the technology side or the product building side, everybody needs help, right, to do startups. So you're going to get with a team or a founder who is going to need your technical help or other help. And you slowly start doing that and working. And then, you know, as soon as your visa stuff is clear, you can do it. I think the second big trend is, you know, in the 80s and 90s, a lot of immigrants had to deal with, semi-racist things, right, in the Bay. And most of the immigrants were engineering roles, right? Now you see like immigrants CEOs, right? You see immigrants in sales, you see immigrants in marketing. So, I mean, there's even more success stories out there. So there's absolutely no reason not to take the plunge, right?
Did you ever face any of that? That when you started your first company, that subtle racism that you mentioned, did you face any of that in your first?
Yeah, I didn't face the racism part of it, but this was earlier than my company. I think my company was a pretty smooth process for me. But even before that, when I was working, though, people, although I was in, I was trying to take the shift to marketing, and I was actually a marketeer, people kept thinking like I'm in IT, or people kept thinking I was an engineer. So the good part was, you know, people thought I was already technical, right? But then they didn't give me more credit than that, right? People like didn't expect you to be in marketing or thinking strategy, right?
Love it. So you actually used your perceived role as engineer to your advantage.
Right. I mean, I have a background in engineering, but you know, that wasn't like, you know, I wasn't trying to get a job as a programmer, right? But because, you know, all the immigrants have an image of being like technically brilliant, you know, I was technically good, but I wasn't brilliant. But
there is this term that I like a lot, which is try to convert your bugs into features.
So, yeah, in this case, you know, you just don't say anything and let them assume whatever they want to assume. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you have a company before your travels and one after, right? Is there any difference in the way that you approach entrepreneurship after the travel? Did travel equip you in any way?
Yeah, I think earlier the company was about the fascination with the product and the idea and the technology, right? And the efficiency it brings to the system, right? So, but now the company is about, what they call the triple bottom line, right? People, planet, and profits. So, you know, profit is one of the equations, but, you know, I always actively think about what it is bringing to my life, what is it bringing to the team's life, right? How is it improving their life, personally improving their emotional and physical life, right? And what is it an impact on society, right? And on the planet? Like, is it bringing good to them? Is it supporting the planet? Or is it just some cool, stupid app, right? That doesn't add any value. So you're, as you see, you know, my horizon is much more widened now and more inclusive than, you know, a just little cool thing, a little technology that I built. So it's because of the experiences reshaping my view.
Got it. So it's more meaningful for entrepreneurship is more meaningful to you now than it was before.
Yeah. Saying was earlier, I thought only Bill Gates was an entrepreneur, right? Now I think even Gandhiji is an entrepreneur. And even Martin Luther King is an entrepreneur, right? Whoever is trying to bring a big change is an entrepreneur.
Yeah, makes sense. So before we finish here, Samir, any book that you want to recommend to the listener?
Yeah, so what's, you know, currently on my mind is, you know, I met Matthew Ricard yesterday. His name is MATTHIEU and RICARD, Ricard. This book is definitely growing on me. It's called Altruism, Altruism. It's a nice overview of all kinds of things that are happening to the world and what you can bring to the table, right? And in the Bay Area, most of us are very well educated, very privileged, right? And, you know, we want to use our skills for good. And, you know, this is a great starting point for that. For the spiritual journey, you know, I would recommend one of my favorite books called Siddhartha by a German author, Hermann Hesse. And for folks who are just starting out their startups, I would highly recommend a book called Running Lean. It's by Ash Maurya. That will really, really help you in the earlier stages to filter your idea and also get to product market fit quickly.
Yeah, so the links to the books will be in the show notes. Thank you for recommending those, Samir. So if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best place to connect with you online?
So yeah, please connect with me on LinkedIn. That's the best way to connect. And you can also follow me on Twitter. So my Twitter handle is at Meet Samir, MEETSAMIR.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us today, Samir.
Thank you so much, Rohit. It was a pleasure talking to you and wish you good luck.
Thank you, Samir. And thank you, everyone, today for joining us. All the show notes with the links mentioned can be found at breakingtheborders.com/session2. Please make sure you subscribe while you're there checking out the show notes. And also, if you got anything of value out of this, make sure you leave iTunes rating and review, and I'll see you another week.